Welcome to episode 25, part B of Rick Brown Story Podcast. I promise this will be the last one on the Aguila saga. Suzuki and Opel, two different companies coming from two different cultures. They're polar opposites in a way. It's almost a study in social science. Both are car companies pursuing similar objectives, high productivity, best quality, and lowest cost. They're all the same, but the path to get there are somewhat different. Suzuki is a big and unique company. They dominate India, and despite what people say, they will continue to do so, and have led the mini segment in Japan over the years, putting up good fights against Toyota and Honda. Suzuki also has tremendous foresight. Being a pioneer in India is one example. Another one is in Hungary. Their story of working with the Hungarian government before and after the collapse of communism to establish a plant in Magyar is a fascinating geopolitical drama. Even with their stronghold in Hungary, Suzuki, however, is not a major player in Europe. In 2003, they only sold around 190,000 units. Over the Aguila project, Suzuki and Opel learned a lot from each other. Hibi-san from Suzuki and Arno from Opel, who were in the trenches of this development project, shared several interesting insights. Here are some examples. First, about corrosion and rust warranty on cars. Europe and Japan are obviously very different in terms of climate, road conditions, and of course, customer expectations. When I came to Detroit from Los Angeles in 1985 to go work for GM, we brought two cars, Dodge Caravan and Honda Civic Station Wagon. The bottom of these two cars just fell off after driving them through one nasty winter. In Japan, unless you are in Hokkaido or some areas along the Sea of Japan, you don't worry too much about heavy snowfall and its effect on your cars. Instead, the Japanese tend to focus more on other features like ride comfort, safety, and fuel economy. Of course, Europeans too, but they also care just as much about vehicle protection from cold winter months, meaning they want the right insurance coverage for vehicle corrosion and other winter damages. For the Aguila, Opel offered a 12-year warranty, and of course, Suzuki felt they needed to match that as well. Hibi-san said it was definitely a lesson learned for Suzuki. Next, torque wrench specifications. To tighten a bolt, you take out a wrench set to a certain specification and torque it or twist it. Opel felt Suzuki's bolts broke too easily. Of course, Suzuki did not agree, and that led to long discussions. Suzuki saw that in order for the torque to be applied evenly and consistently, Opel lubricated both bolts and nuts. This lubrication reduces friction between threads as well as avoids over or under tightening. Suzuki thought that lubricant would loosen the bolts, and to them it was just one extra process that costs money. But Opel and other OEMs did it that way, and that was another contentious discussion. Another discussion that they had was over door hinges. Door hinges enable smooth opening and closing of doors. They also provide support and stability during assembly. You can imagine how important this component is considering how often we open and close doors. Opel and Suzuki had two different types of hinges. Opel used welded hinges, while Suzuki has always installed pressed hinges. The Suzuki approach is, of course, more cost-effective, has less weight, better design freedom, easier to assemble, and yes, better corrosion protection. There are also good reasons for welded pieces too, like better strength and durability, easier to customize the part, and more rigid connection to the body, and some even look better. You chose either based on tradition and brand preferences. As you can see, there are both pros and cons of each approach. Imagine the arguments that ensued. In the end, Suzuki ended up going with Opel's approach for the Magyar plant. Hibi-san's overall impression on this topic was realizing how stubborn Germans were in insisting upon their approach. He thought this was not a very good decision, probably thinking a lot about the cost impact. But since Suzuki had overall technical responsibility for the project, even for manufacturing engineering, they grudgingly went along. There was also another interesting discussion. When you set your windshield wipers to the normal standard setting, do you notice how many times your wipers go back and forth? Of course, the actual number of cycles vary depending on the model and its specifications. And yes, Suzuki and Opel argue about that too. Suzuki wipers normally swung twice, while Opel vehicles went double that number. Suzuki proposed three times as a compromise, but no, Opel insisted on four. That's stubbornness again. Opel won this argument as well, and Germans do not make compromises so easily. So on the door hinges and windshield wipers, Opel did not budge and in the end had their way. Now car seats, which was another discussion. European car makers treat car seats very seriously and carefully. Opel and Suzuki tested a number of prototypes to determine its optimal hardness and support features. Especially for the second generation Agila, Suzuki also engineered very hard seats into their vehicle. While Opel called it Agila, Suzuki's name for the first generation was Wagonar Plus, which eventually became Splash. Did not sell many in Japan, but according to Hibi-san, automotive critics in Japan praised the Suzuki seat, labeling it the best among Japanese OEMs. Suzuki still used these seats to their advantage, a great learning from Opel. I mentioned corrosion insurance. No one wants high insurance rates. Europeans are no exceptions. Through working with Opel, Suzuki came to understand the value of maintaining close relationships to companies like Thatcham in England or GDB or German Insurance Association. These companies or associations play an important part in setting insurance rates in Europe. They greatly influence the rates insurance companies offer to customers through their research and data analysis. Both run their own crash and security tests on each new or updated model and share results with insurance companies to help them set rates. Naturally, safer cars and those less prone to thefts and accidents, for instance, get lower insurance rating. European auto manufacturers maintain good relationships with these organizations in order to improve their own relative quality, durability, and performance based on their input. Suzuki learned that from Opel, that this interaction with such companies would lead to improvement in vehicle coverage, which was another learning from Opel on the part of Suzuki. You all heard of Autobahn in Germany. Though more and more of them now have speed limits, Europeans tend to drive much faster. In Japan, speed limits are strictly followed. There is a test called Elk test. Yes, elk, as moose are known in Europe. It assesses a vehicle's ability to perform its evasive maneuvers safely and effectively. Assessment typically involves a sudden lane change at high speeds to simulate avoiding an obstacle like an elk. There are no tests like that in Japan for various reasons. One, road conditions are different, and safety standards of models in Japan are also very stringent, and regulators feel those measures in place substantially assure and guarantee the safety of cars. However, when Japanese models are exported to certain countries, they are required to pass the Elk test. Regarding Opel Agila, when Mercedes-Benz failed the Elk test around the launch of Opel Agila, the team felt the need to reevaluate the model to make sure it can also pass the test. Opel ran additional tests and decided to add ballast to the floor to improve stability. It's essentially a weighted material added to the vehicle floor to enhance stability and balance. Hibi-san and other Suzuki engineers thought this approach was a bit rudimentary and over the top. It was kind of understandable for Opel to think that way because the Benz failure sort of became a big news item in Europe. European journalists just did not let this incident go. They were out to find more cars that would tip over as the Mercedes A did. And that resulted in strengthening of European safety requirements. Mercedes overcame the problem through design and engineering improvements. Nevertheless, the incident forced each OEM to re-examine their own vehicle safety. Achieving stability and optimal vehicle weight is something that is designed and engineered into each vehicle. Thus, Suzuki thought Opel Agila also cleared the hurdle through the design phase. This one just happened to coincide with the Mercedes failure, which probably led to doing something extreme. Nothing is easy, and we had our battles, but mostly for good reasons. Opal had tremendous respect for Suzuki, and the feeling was very mutual. There's no easy joint project, but just like the GM-Suzuki alliance itself, one of the most successful automotive alliances ever, this Opel-Agila project was also a success in many respects. This is what Hibi-san said about his learning. Importance of speaking your mind directly. Japanese, as you know, have what is called honne and tatemae. Honne means expressing one's true feeling, while tatemae is more of a facade. You could stand in front of an art object and share your true feelings about how you feel, or say something just to be nice to the artist in presence. You can feel the difference. Japanese also pay too much attention to hierarchy and also clamor up often in the presence of bosses and make them uncomfortable speaking freely. Nothing is stronger than speaking your mind, honestly and directly. That is the way to engage in debates effectively. I'm very glad that Hibi-san and many colleagues that I have come to be friends with recall the Opel engagement with fond memories, both privately and professionally. As I mentioned in the previous episode, Arno Will, a member of the Opel Agila team, also shared with me his thoughts that I'd like to share with you. Companies come together to synergize each other's capability in order to build a top-notch vehicle with a focus on the right things like cost containment, technology integration, leveraging combined volume and purchasing, or platform conversion even. Developing a synergy list is easy. Making it happen is totally a different game. Ask any person who was involved in alliance management. Yet with strong desire to synergize, each manufacturer has to also maintain and project its own brand image. Opel cannot just take a Suzuki vehicle and slap its badge on it. Companies achieve that through differentiation and always weighing the desire with cost impact. One area of differentiation Opel pursued and Arno took the lead on was powertrain. Opel wanted their own engines, while Suzuki naturally preferred their own. Opel, around that time, introduced a brand new engine called Family Zero, and Arno came from that project center. Opel needed engines in anticipation of stricter emission standards and offer high-tech engines for their Corsa and Astra models, Opel's smallest platforms. Upon reaching the Agila deal with Suzuki, Opel rightly so insisted on having its own engine, Family Zero 1.2-liter double overhead cam engine, or the DOC. With acceptance by Suzuki, the first powertrain lineup for the program was Suzuki's 1-liter base engine and Opel Family Zero 1.2-liter engine, both using Suzuki's 5-speed transmission. But around the first prototype experience, Opel decided, with Suzuki's consent, to have Family Zero 3-cylinder 1-liter engine in the Agila with Suzuki's transmission. Arno, who first came to Suzuki as a representative to handle Opel's interface throughout this transition, was in the midst of all these discussions. He said, during the project, he spent almost 365 days in Japan between 1997 and 2000. That's a lot of visits. As a result, he even wrote a pamphlet on how to get to Suzuki's headquarters in Hamamatsu from Narita Airport. 365 days in Japan, imagine that. He felt that GM was so anxious to get this project going that we missed the opportunities to achieve better positioning of Opel in the project. I'm sure Suzuki felt the same way. But again, both sides insisting to maximize their prospective way will always pull the teams apart. I've seen too many projects come undone because no one was willing to listen and to accommodate. Arno interacted closely with our team in Japan as well as with Suzuki engineers. I mentioned before about Suzuki opening up a space for us on the engineering floor with certain limitations. Arno was a free spirit. Some felt he was a bit too invasive, in that he was not shy about going directly to speak to an engineer sitting at his desk, sort of stepping over the line from the Opel space to the sanctity of the Suzuki engineering floor. I understand how some people might felt that way, but Arno was also just doing his job. And him doing that was okay to many Suzuki engineers. And also, you can't miss Arno. He's a big guy. And on the other hand, I probably blend in better, like things like that, if you can imagine. Opel had a bunch of people come over. Some of them were mechanics and shop floor technicians who have probably never left their comfortable surroundings, let alone stepping into Japan. No English, no experience dealing with people like Suzuki folks. But for Suzuki, they were no different and treated them the same way. I hope these humble, skilled technicians live to tell their grandchildren their fond memories of this experience working with Suzuki. In the previous episode, I talked about how Opel and Suzuki worked differently. According to Arno, the prototype phase was also showed a stark difference between Opel and Suzuki. Opel tested prototypes at their Dudenhof testing track, while Suzuki used their own facilities in Ryuyo. And if I'm not mistaken, at Sagara facility as well. And they exchanged, of course, their test data. Each company has its way of testing, a series of things to go through, a test cycle to follow, and not all of them are similar. On some components, Suzuki had a more stringent test sequence, while less than Opel on other parameters. Imagine coordinating something like that. That difference, again, comes from history and experience. And GM, for instance, has testing facilities all over the world, including Detroit, Germany, Brazil, and Australia. Fortunately, I have seen them all. It took a while for GM to standardize the testing procedures across its own testing facilities. One easy example that non-engineers can see and appreciate would be the difference in the depth of potholes. Not everyone agreed how hard a car should hit a pothole to assure its durability. Again, things like that engineers took very seriously, very, very seriously. One thing that Arno wanted to mention was an incident involving a failure of Suzuki's transmission in one of our tests. Everyone was totally surprised that it failed, but the root cause immediately surfaced. Suzuki and Opel just used different transmission oil. That was the reason. Parts numbering systems were different and created a complicated and tedious situation. You could not just load Suzuki parts onto Opel's IT system. Drawings were not the same, and not only they were different, but Suzuki often used drawings prepared by the suppliers and after review just to approve them. For most of the common parts, there were minimum needed to convert Suzuki parts numbering systems to the Opel standard because they did not affect Opel engineering. Suzuki did all the work, but not in powertrain. They had to engineer the integration of their engines into the Opel Agila. Lots of grunt work, but had to be done. Excellent teamwork with Suzuki, done by a group of very capable production personnel. These activities require constant monitoring and quick changes resulting from various tests. In Arno's view, Suzuki's process to request and execute changes was very quick and timely. They just picked up the phone and called the supplier to make the necessary changes, whereas Opel, the change process required much more rigid approval procedures. This speed is definitely an advantage. Suzuki or its Hungarian plant always had newer parts in the plant before Opel did, a freedom that Opel engineers would love to have had, but it did not. Of course, Suzuki had to formalize these, what appears to be informal changes later with purchasing and others. But it was nonetheless impressive in terms of ease and speed, a learning for Arno and the Opel team. Arno was also quite impressed with Suzuki's work ethic. Suzuki certainly put in more hours than their Opel counterparts. He was amazed at seeing young Suzuki engineers going out drinking with their Opel visitors after work and then get back to their office for more work. Suzuki had an HR practice whereby a senior manager soon to retire would spend his last 2 years working in the area of his expertise. Of course, in order to pass on the knowledge to younger colleagues. I am sure similar processes happen in other Japanese OEMs, but at least within GM, I don't think we were organized like that. It may happen on isolated basis, but not an organized HR practice for sure. We don't even do sufficient job transition between departing and incoming managers. mm. I think this practice is a must, especially now where people tend to move around much more frequently. The last thing Arnold mentioned, which I thought was worthwhile telling, was his impression of Mr. Suzuki, Osamu Suzuki, then chairman of Suzuki Motor Company. He is 20 years older than me, but one would never know that. Very energetic, focused, and relentless about cost-cutting, productivity improvement, and quality enhancement. Some of us were lucky enough to witness his biannual plant audits. This is not by any means a surprise audit, but formally scheduled twice a year. He would visit every Suzuki plant for the purpose of doing an audit. There's no way to prepare for these audits. Mr. Suzuki had a mind of his own and goes where he wanted to go. No established routes, no time limit, nothing planned. As he walked around, he talks to people up and down the plant hierarchy, observing carefully, pointing out opportunities for Kaizen. In most cases, areas where even plant managers and those on the line would not notice. He would point out an area, those following him would take careful notes, and when he returns for the next audit, Mr. Suzuki makes sure that that issue had a good follow-up and accomplished what he wanted. Tom Lasorda witnessed this while at Cami. And of course, Ikuma-san, head of Cami, himself a manufacturing executive who had seen these audits over the years, also did similar things at Cami. And Tom took his approach with him to future assignments, including his tenure at Eisenach in Germany. In some quarters, people snicker at practices like this because the one doing the audit often has no idea what is really going on. They just follow the script, thinking making presence itself is good enough. Osamu Suzuki was not like that. He knew every corner of each plant, remembered what he talked about at his previous audit, and expected good follow-up. In fact, he knew every corner of Suzuki. Nothing escaped from his prying eyes. Again, back to Tom, he learned that as well. While working for him at Eisenach, that's what he tried to do, to be familiar with every aspect of the business, from knowing everyone's name to daily production numbers. This Opal Aguila story could go on, but I should bring it to an end. If anyone is interested, having heard these recent episodes, I'd welcome feedback, and if appropriate, I'd be happy to share them with listeners. So finally, Arnold says, we had a press event in Sardinia prior to launch. I personally remember launching Opal Aguila in Geneva, Switzerland. But since Opal Astra Coupe was first introduced in 2000 in Sardinia, the official launch or not, something did occur in Sardinia, and how soon you forget. And by then, I was off to the next assignment. Maybe the reason my mind was starting to deviate from the Aguila activities. Following the Mercedes-Chrysler merger, one thing led to another. Jack Smith, then chairman of GM, got me involved in discussions with Suzuki to raise our stake in the company. And next thing I know, I found myself working in Japan, the start of a 10-year stint. Again, a topic too big to organize and summarize, but I will do my best to go deep into my memory bank and share those days with you in future Rick Brown Story podcast episodes. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you, Hibi-san and Arnold, for helping me out. Thank you again. Bye-bye.